Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome back to The Play's the Thing here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I'm joined by an old friend, Tim McIntosh. You know Tim. Tim, say hello to the people.
Hi, people.
And then a new friend, Sarah.
They caught me off guard. Sorry, David. They caught me off guard.
I know. I changed it up. I mixed it up on you.
I know you did.
And then we have a new friend who's joining us and her name is Sarah Jane Bentley. Sarah Jane, welcome to The Play's the Thing. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me. It's really exciting to be here on the podcast.
Sarah Jane is a teacher at Eton in England and is very knowledgeable about Shakespeare and has become a friend of the Kern family and Circe in general. And I was chatting with her about Shakespeare and various other literary things. And I thought to myself, Sarah Jane needs to come on the podcast. And we needed to fill in, you know, some people here on The Play's a Thing. And she seemed like the ideal fit. So, you know, we made her do it. And she has stooped and acquiesced to joining us on the show. So again, thanks for being here. We're here to discuss Othello.
I like how you kind of set me up there super knowledgeable and then you gave me the backhanded compliment of being the fill-in as well.
I noticed that also.
See, like the play Othello, it's all about paradox, right?
Okay.
Nicely done.
We are here to discuss Othello. We're going to discuss Act 1. We're going to get into some higher level things about the play before we dive into as much as we can of these first three scenes here in Act 1. I want to remind you about all the different ways you can get in touch with us. You can, of course, join the conversation over on the Facebook group. The Close Reads Podcast group is the name of that group, so you can just search that if you have not joined that already. As always, there will be plenty of discussion going on about this play. If you're not listening to the Close Reads flagship show, you should be doing that because we are discussing the Odyssey. We're going to be discussing books 9 and 10 this week. Of course, we have the Daily Poem and everything else is going on here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. If you want to join us on social media, you can follow at Close Reads Pods on Instagram and on Twitter. And finally, we have the Close Reads newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. That's S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K for Substack. So closereads.substack.com. And that's where you can, you know, we'll send out information on what we're up to, schedules, some resources that we might have to go along with the books that we're reading. So there's plenty of ways to stay in touch and be connected. Hope you will participate in the conversation. Okay, Othello. Let's just start with this. Tim, you mentioned in particular, maybe 6 or 8 months, and I don't remember if you even mentioned this, but you mentioned to me that you really enjoy this play and that you really enjoy the performative nature of this play. And so we, you know, and then you even indicated that you really wanted to be on this series. And I was wondering where your first experience with Othello was. Like, did you see it on the stage first? Did you read it in school first? Did you watch one of the movies or something?
I saw the Lawrence Fishburne movie when it came out in cinemas in the mid-90s, which I look back at the date that it came out, and I think it was 1995. Maybe it was a little bit later than that. And it kind of surprised me that I would go see Othello just 1 year after college, because I did not care much for Shakespeare at all, and I was not much.
Oh, really?
I didn't know much about Shakespeare, and I remember going to see the movie, and I remember being crushed at the end of it. Mm. And the funny thing is, in preparation for the podcast, I went back and I rewatched the Lawrence Fishburne version, and I can't watch the end. It's so awful for me. Mm. It's awful for everyone. The ending of this play is just so brutal.
So did that take you immediately into reading it, or did you read it some years later?
I think I read it some years later.
Okay.
But honestly, I think part of the reason that I wanted to be on the Othello podcast is, of course, I love Shakespeare, but also because this is one of the first times that Shakespeare just really kind of got to me on a really visceral level. Mm.
So in reading it, when you finally got around to reading it, did you find that you were kind of scared or nervous to get to the end?
Yeah, yeah. And I rewatched it, and I turned it off like with 15 minutes left. Mm. I just can't do it. I mean,
Can you read the end?
Yeah, I can read the end, okay. But for some reason, I think that the movie is very well done. It's very short. It's clipped. It's probably 2 hours long. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but I suspect they cut 50% of the text, if not more. Okay. Which is fine. It's a movie.
It's been a long time since I watched that one.
I've never actually seen it as a film. I've only seen it in the theater. Hmm.
Where did you first encounter Othello?
I think it was on a school trip to London, and that we saw it at the Barbican.
Okay.
But my mother was insisting that my school never took us on a trip to London. So it might have been somewhere like Bristol. But I'm pretty sure it was the Barbican.
Okay.
And then later on, I saw it at the Trafalgar Studios with Lenny Henry as Othello, which was a really interesting casting because he's a very famous comedian. Huh. So this was a publicly famous comedian playing the tragic role of Othello. And then it was on quite recently here as a school play as well, which was excellent. Mm.
Okay, so I want to kind of hold on to that idea of a comedian playing this character because there does seem to be some characteristics of Shakespeare's comedies that are kind of layered throughout this play, and maybe we can talk about that over the next couple of weeks. But did they play it as a really serious thing, or did they draw on his comedic chops, so to speak, to kind of draw out some of the comedy of the play? Did they play it as a dark comedy? Did they bring any comedy in or any levity at all? Or did he play it totally seriously?
I think you have to play Othello, the character, as totally serious. The comedy comes in with Iago, probably.
Yeah.
But, and with the kind of the generic structures that Shakespeare's using. But the idea of a jealous husband as a character is a comic figure. But part of the comedy is that he doesn't realize that he's unreasonable, I suppose. Mm.
So now that I've given you the floor, I had said that I was going to have you introduce yourself a little bit. So let's let people have some context for who you are now that we're into the conversation a little bit, because I want to use that as a bridge into the next question I have. So tell people who you are, what you do. I mentioned that your name is Sarah Jane Bentley and you teach at Eton. So far, we know that much.
I mean, there isn't a lot more to know, really. I'm a school teacher. I've probably been teaching for about 10 years or so. Taught in mostly in an all-boys school, but I've also taught in an all-girls school and a little bit in schools of boys and girls, but all sort of older children, 13 to 18 years old.
Okay.
Sarah Jane, your discipline is Shakespeare specifically? It's literature more broadly?
Yes, it's definitely broad. I mean, I did an English degree at Oxford, so I studied a lot of Shakespeare, and I've kind of continued to study because it's necessary as a teacher. So every time a new text comes up to be taught on the syllabus, then I will intensively study that for maybe a few months and then teach it for a year perhaps. And so over the years, I kind of started to get to know the plays a bit better just because I have the luxury of revisiting them all the time. Yeah. And talking to young people about them. Yeah. But I wouldn't say I'm, you know, a scholar or an expert on Shakespeare at all.
Well, perfect. Then you fit in well.
Okay.
No. Well, the reason I wanted to ask you that now is because you mentioned that you're teaching these with young people. And Tim, you have taught Shakespeare on the college level. And I was wondering where this play for your students I guess, how they respond to it and where it seems to fit in terms of their, you know, like if you're asking your students what their Mount Rushmore of Shakespeare play is, although maybe that's too an American reference that we should avoid with an English person on the show. Where does this play seem to fall? Because I was thinking about this, and when you talk to people about Shakespeare, it seems to fall sort of in that second tier for a lot of people, you know, maybe Lear and Hamlet and then The Tempest or whatever. There seems to be a certain grouping of plays that often gets mentioned, Macbeth, for example. Does that hold true for your students? Sarah Jane, I'll let you answer that. What do they generally think of this play? Do they like it? Are they afraid of it like Tim is?
Are they afraid of it? I think it has a different sort of resonance perhaps to something like Macbeth, Lear, Coriolanus, Antony and Cleopatra, which Shakespeare hadn't written yet by the time this play was out there. It's because we're not dealing with a tragedy of a king or, you know, Othello's a general and he's a Moor. So I think sometimes it does take a little bit more effort to say to the boys, no, this is a tragedy that really is significant and really matters. Because even if it's more kind of domestic, if you like.
That's interesting. So teaching in a country where the idea of a king is something that is much more a part of your everyday life, I suppose, or your sort of cultural consciousness than it is here, obviously. Does that then, do you think that might impact your students more than, like, the fact that it's not about a king or the questions of kingship or succession or something like that? Do you think that might be something that makes it less meaningful to them than, you know, in a way that maybe doesn't impact, say, Tim's students?
No, I don't think it makes it less meaningful. I just think that they perhaps are a little bit more aware that it is different, perhaps, to some of the other major tragedies.
Yeah. So maybe the other plays become meaningful in that way more than they would for Tim's students, because the question of kingship is not as relevant to their students. Maybe I'm talking about something that doesn't matter at all.
No, David, the question you're asking at least makes sense to me. It makes sense to me, because I feel like... when I read Shakespeare's plays and I read about, let's say, the history plays, I don't know the kings of England in the same way that I would think that Sarah Jane and Sarah Jane's students know the kings of England.
Yeah.
That's kind of it's at the root of your question, right, David?
Yeah. And I kind of think of, like, what sort of, we have these instinctive responses to plays and to stories. And, you know, Tim, you mentioned that when you first saw Othello for the first time, you had this really deeply emotional, instinctive sort of response to the ending. And sometimes those instinctive responses color things in ways that we don't anticipate, or that maybe we don't anticipate our students having. The sentence I just said doesn't make sense, but you know what I mean.
I see.
And so I was kind of wondering, like, instinctively, is there something about this play that keeps it sort of from being one of the plays that most people love the most? Or does it just not get read as much? I don't know. Is it part of your syllabus every year at Eton, Sarah Jane?
No. And the syllabus is probably much more kind of general across the country as a whole, in that, you know, it depends, because we do public exams here, which you don't in the States. It's more to do with which exam board you choose, basically.
Okay.
So it's not a kind of personal choice of the school to teach this text. It's sometimes there as a choice, and it's a popular one, definitely. I think it probably goes quite well with The Merchant of Venice as a slightly, not a problematic play, but kind of...
Right.
It's not your typical big tragedy, if you know what I mean.
And I have never taught this play, and it's never been a part of a mandatory curriculum that I've ever taught, and I've never seen a live public performance of Othello. And to be honest, aside from in Ashland, so Sarah Jane, I used to live in Eugene, Oregon, which is about 4 hours north of Ashland, Oregon. And Ashland, Oregon is kind of in the middle of nowhere, but I don't know, 50 years ago they started a Shakespeare festival, and I think it's absolutely world class. They've done Othello, and I've known that they've done Othello. I've just never made it down there to see it. So I've never seen a live performance of Othello. And I think that part of the reason why is because it's not performed very frequently outside of really, I think, large and well-established theaters in the United States that right. do focus a lot on Shakespeare because of the racial, I'm not even going to say overtone, because of the racial content of the subject matter, which especially, I mean, both in England and the United States is so complicated. And I think that a lot of theaters are probably a little bit afraid of it.
Yeah. And I really, I get what you're saying as well about, you know, if you're watching it as a film, how intense it is and how difficult it is to watch the ending. Well, if you can imagine in the theater what that's like, it's so relentless, this play, the build up to the inevitable climax. And yeah, it is painful to watch. Maybe that's another reason why people don't like to perform it or put it on.
I like that you use the word relentless, though, because I was thinking about how much the relentlessness of it makes it, well, perhaps not enjoyable to read. Maybe that's the wrong word. It certainly makes it very readable. You know, we're dropped right into it, right in the middle from the first line. Shakespeare and these characters are not beating around the bush, so to speak. I mean, we're thrown right into it. And even though these, you know, act one is not necessarily short, these three scenes are not necessarily short in and of themselves. They are very readable because there is this relentlessness to it. I like that word a lot. I hadn't thought of that word previously. I was thinking about how even in this first act, there's different verse forms that Shakespeare's using. You know, like you see when Iago and Rodrigo are scheming, what is that, an act? Scene three, maybe? The structure of the language changes. And then you have Othello seems to speak in a way that's different than the other characters in the play. Maybe even differently than the other characters in most Shakespeare plays.
He's horribly stuffed with epithets of war, is what
he does. Yeah. And do you think that that is what is causing the relentlessness? I mean, is it the variety of language, the epithets of war, or is it plot? I guess I'm trying to figure out, is it just that we're thrown into the chaos of the story and the sort of hatefulness of it? Or is it more of a formal thing that Shakespeare is doing with the language and perhaps even the structure? I mean, I know you'd like to talk about the structure of these three scenes, so maybe this is a good time to do that. But I'm wondering if maybe is this question of relentlessness a good way into that conversation?
I'm also interested to hear what Tim thinks as well. But to start on that, I'd say that the plotting really is the big driver of the tension. And obviously Iago's the kind of dynamic behind that plotting. He seems to over orchestrate everything and have more control than he ought to have as the mere ancient. The language itself, you're right, does shift between prose, it shifts between verse. In Act 1, Scene 3, we have the Doge of Venice speaking in rhyming couplets, which is even more formal, perhaps, than we're used to. And there are moments in the play where there can be a release of tension by a shift into prose, but then equally, you know, at a really tense moment, like when Othello is completely broken down, he's having a fit, the thing that's so relentless there is that he's lost this ability to speak with such eloquence. So I think Shakespeare treats the form of the poetry in accordance with the drama that's happening at that time in the scene. I don't think there's a hard and fast rule about it. Does that kind of make sense, do you think?
It does.
Yeah. Tim, go ahead.
Othello struck me. There's a line, I can't remember it exactly, where Othello says that he's not terribly eloquent. And that line is surrounded by all of this eloquence. And it reminded me of the beginning of Mark Antony's speech when he's, you know, he's not an eloquent man, he says. And then he comes out with one of the most beautiful speeches in the English language. And Othello strikes me the same way. But I picked up on the exact same thing, Sarah Jane, that you picked up on. The metaphors are so militaristic. And I think part of the power, and we don't even get to know, we have not met Desdemona except by reputation. But when she finally steps out on stage, I kind of had this sense, here is this powerful general whose mindset is bent completely on war making and establishing victory. It's part of the reason why he's so valuable in this context to these people. Mm-hmm. How is this going to work? How is this going to work between the two of them when his mind is so full of arms and so full of weaponry? You know, like, I think even on a subconscious sort of level, there's a sense that Doom may be riding up on its very well armored horse before Desdemona even arrives on the stage.
Do you know that painting by Botticelli of Mars and Venus?
When Venus is taking the armor off of Mars.
Yes, yeah, yes. Exactly. That's what should happen, right? That Mars should submit to Venus, that love should conquer war. And when we find out in the beginning about how Desdemona has been wooed by Othello, it's not the right way around. Othello hasn't fallen for her. She's fallen for him.
And his exploits,
yes. And this is kind of the problem, as you say, that you can see from the beginning, there's a kind of doom here, that Mars never takes his armor off.
Yeah.
I was thinking about how that scene where Desdemona's father brings this case against him and is sort of enraged. And on the one hand, it's this question of, this is not the kind of person she should be with. You know, it's kind of a prejudicial take, right?
Hmm.
And so I was wondering is Shakespeare, on the one hand, there is this sort of, as Tim said, it's not even an undertone, right? Or it's just, the racist stuff is all right there, right? And so on the one hand, there's this very prejudiced way that he is looking at Othello and the reasons that he doesn't want his daughter to be with Othello. But then on the other hand, is there any, well, I think one of the questions is there any justice in his complaint if you take out just the racist aspect of it? Like, is he wrong
yeah.
to not want Desdemona to be with Othello, given who Othello is as a person and the reasons that she fell for him? So if you take, I think that's one of the things that complicates the play and the character of Othello in some ways. Because on the one hand, especially to a contemporary reader, the race question is sort of despicable, right? On the other hand,
it's so front and center that it might overwhelm, this is what I hear you saying, David, it might overwhelm any other reasons why Desdemona and Othello might actually not be a good match in other ways, like the ones that Sarah Jane and I were just talking about. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's yes, exactly. And so is there any justice in the case that the father's making if you take that despicable bit out?
Right.
Well, it's a really great question to ask, because it's obviously a question that Shakespeare asks, because he gives us a court scene where the Doge of Venice, who is like unbelievably high status, hears the case before he even discusses the matter of the war in Cyprus.
Yeah.
And he clearly doesn't think it's unjust. And the other question that we have to ask Brabantio is, well, how did Desdemona come to hear this story of Othello's? Like, why was Othello in your house? And obviously the answer is because Brabantio had invited him in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you guys, I just want to read a couple of lines and know what you thought of these. So the Duke exiting after the court scene has been resolved.
Where are you? In
Desdemona's father. This is 3. Line for me, 289 and 290. So he says, good night to everyone and noble senor. If virtue no delighted beauty lack, your son-in-law is more fair than black.
Hmm.
I thought, that's a complicated couple lines. And I think it's intended to be a compliment to Othello, and it's meant to assuage the father's concerns. But what a peculiar way of saying it.
Yeah, it's appealing to Brabantio, I think, to recognize the virtue of Othello, which the Duke is saying is greater than his visible appearance. That his nobility kind of shines forth, if you like. And that's one of the problems for Othello, I think, that's so difficult. As you were saying, that he's kind of obsessed with war, and it's almost that he has to be, because he's trying to be more Venetian than the Venetians. He's got to be virtuously whiter than they are, if you like.
Yeah. Sarah Beth, I wanted to ask this question, and maybe now is the time. What would Shakespeare's audience have thought when they saw a Moor on stage?
Yeah, it's a really, really fascinating question. I don't think there's a straightforward answer. In the same way that when we go to the theatre now, not everyone has the same response to the entry of a particular character. But there was, in the time of Elizabeth, towards the end of her reign, in about 1600, I think, there was an ambassador from Arabia, so the Barbary ambassador, who was called Abd el-Wahid ben Masud, who came into court very publicly, and lots of people would have seen him. And there's a painting of him, actually, that you can find on the internet. And so I don't think the idea of a noble Moor would have been alien to the audience, something that they would have seen, and it's certainly something that Shakespeare would have seen himself. So then the really interesting question about Othello's race is, do we think that he is a Moor in the sense of being an Arab? Is he Barbary? Or is he a sub-Saharan African, as some of the more racist taunts that are hurled at him suggest, like Rodrigo calls him thick lips, for example. And so it's quite difficult in the play to really answer that question, because a lot of things suggest that he's maybe a converted Muslim, so he has a kind of Ottoman background. But then there are these references to him being black as opposed to tawny, which is the word used to describe the Prince of Morocco in The Merchant of Venice, for example. So there's an ambiguity there.
Well, and it's complicated by the actor factor, isn't it? I mean, Richard Burbage would have played him?
Yeah, it would have been definitely.
He would not have been.
No.
He would not have been as dark as, and would he have been even tawny, to use that? Would he have been like that? Or how would they have approached that? I mean, or was he, I mean, they wouldn't have done like a, what we would call blackface today, would they?
Yes, I think they would, yeah.
So do you know anything about what they would have done in Shakespeare's day to transform Richard Burbage? Or what they did, do you know anything?
Well, there would have been, I imagine, quite a realistic costume, because a lot of the costumes were donated to them by the nobility. And Shakespeare's company of players at this time were doing really well. They'd just progressed from being the Lord Chamberlain's men to the King's men. So this is the first play, I think, that Shakespeare writes for King James I. And so, yeah, I imagine the character of Othello would be a spectacle and that he would need to look exotic.
Would they have been able to do that? Or I guess, how would they have done that without making it seem comic? Do you think that would have been an issue? I guess maybe, I mean, maybe you don't know the mechanics of it, but
I don't know. I mean, you could say the same thing. Would male actors dressing up as women have been seen as comic? I don't really think it would have necessarily.
Suspension of disbelief and all that.
Yeah. Why not?
I read a quote by Laurence Olivier in which he imagined Burbage saying to Shakespeare that, you know, hey, Bill, I can play anything you want me to play. And then Shakespeare wrote Othello to kind of like say, oh, right, okay, I'll fix you. Let's see this.
Yeah.
Was this, what was the response to this play when it was first performed? Do you know?
Well, there were various responses, but there's one particular critic called Reimer who really hated it. He called it the tragedy of a handkerchief. He thought that it was ridiculous, that it was a farce. So there was some rejection of it as a tragedy at all, because the one of the interesting questions about Othello's race is, if he's a sort of Arabic Moor, then he has more dignity and nobility in the kind of Jacobean sense than he does if this is just the tragedy of a sub-Saharan African. So there was a kind of, well, Reimer at least suggests that as a tragedy, it was kind of questioned when it was first on the stage.
Well, T.S. Eliot didn't like it. So I guess
he didn't like it, David?
T.S. Eliot, but he also has a reputation for, you know, picking fights with Shakespeare's greatness. So. Or at least he didn't care for the character of Othello.
Did you feel like the first act was act five of a comedy? It felt to me that, you know, we have the wrongful accusation, which so often happens in the comedies. We have the injustice is brought to the light of day. A magistrate, I'm thinking especially of something like Measure for Measure. a magistrate pronounces justice, and it culminates in a marriage. And even though the marriage has happened off stage in Othello, it feels like a marriage scene because there's this kind of like pronouncement that we've made our vows to each other. Desdemona says to her father, you know, my rightful duty now is with my husband. And it's funny because it's almost like Othello felt to me like the end of a comedy begins our play, and we have these sprinklings of doom throughout the first act, and those seeds of doom slowly grow during 2, 3, and 4 until they finally just take over the entire play in 5.
I love that idea. Can I put forward a slightly opposite one just for fun?
Please.
So if we compare Othello to Twelfth Night and The Tempest, going along with this idea that it has a kind of comic overtone, if you like, both of those plays start with a storm. And Othello, we know in the next act, is about to go into the storm and on the way to Cyprus. And so, yeah, you're right. It starts with a kind of storm and then moves to a kind of resolution at the end. Whereas normally with tragedy, we'd expect it the other way around.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. It does begin with things seeming to be resolved in this court case presided over by the Doge. And then it all starts to unravel afterwards,
And yet, even though we know that, like, practically speaking, maybe that particular case has been resolved, we know from the very first lines of the play that whatever Brabantio ends up accepting, you know, that he's not really the actual guy that they have to overcome. Brabantio's not really the villain or the one who's really going to get in the way of Desdemona and Othello being happy. From the very beginning, you get there's this plot against them that then Brabantio kind of gets wrapped up in, but then the resolution's not really a resolution. It's just almost that getting resolved is the thing that pushes the plot of Iago and Rodrigo into, you know, the next level of action.
Well, there's a great haste to resolve it, isn't there? Because the Doge is like, I need to get this domestic squabble out of the way because talk to Othello about is Cyprus. Yeah. The way that Brabantio kind of dismisses all these proverbial bits of wisdom of the Doge by saying, you know, so let the Turk of Cyprus us beguile. We lose it not so long as we can smile, because he's just been told by the Doge, you know, if you can smile at your robber, then you haven't really lost anything. And Brabantio says, yeah, okay, well, fine. Let Cyprus go to the Turks then and smile about it. You know, why is it any different for you? And so at the very beginning of the play, we have this mixture of the public political martial scene and the private domestic scene, which you're right, doesn't really get resolved. That's kind of the problem, if you like.
It's a very, what's the right word? Not pragmatic solution. It's just a solution because the law of marriage has already been enacted and the father is not going to quibble with that, but he's certainly not happy with the match. Mm. But things must go on. We have to send this great general off to war. Mm.
When Othello is telling the story to the Duke and so forth, and he's kind of explaining how he met Desdemona, he says in 1.3, I think it's around 1:28, he says, her father loved me, oft invited me, still questioned me the story of my life from year to year, the battles, sieges, fortunes that I passed. And then he says that I ran it through, even from my boyish days to the very moment that he bade me tell it. And I was thinking about how Brabantio is all about Othello when it comes to his story. Like he's like fascinated by his story. He's fascinated by the adventures that Othello has had and this sort of mysterious soldier and this warrior and the sort of legend of Othello. But then once it comes to him as an actual person falling in love with his daughter, he's not as into that. And it's not that much different, it seems, for the court, right? Like the Duke and the senator are sort of, you know, as long as, look, all we care about is that you go win the battle. Whatever else doesn't really doesn't really matter. They don't seem to care about him as a person particularly either. They care about him for what he can accomplish for them.
What he can achieve for them, yeah. There's a huge hypocrisy here as well, isn't there? That one of the things that Brabantio refuses to accept, it seems, initially, is that Desdemona could be wooed by Othello's words. And he says, but words are words. I never yet did hear that the bruised heart was pierced through the ear. And yet he himself was captivated by Othello's story. And,
right, exactly. Yeah.
So he's sort of a bit deluded or hypocritical there, perhaps.
I think this observation by Shakespeare, this kind of character description of Brabantio, is like Shakespeare at his best, because we've all seen this. I can't help, being from the American South, I can't help but think of the way that African American musicians, for example, were adored by their audiences, esteemed by their audiences, befriended by their audiences, while at the same time their audiences were resisting the civil rights movement. So there's this odd, it's not odd, it's there's this hypocritical sort of stance that in the area of Othello's skill, his great war-making ability, he is an equal, but not really in the other realms. And there's this ability, you know.
Yes, he's not a curled darling.
Right, exactly. And I just see that is not unique to the characters in this play. We've all seen this in our lives, that a person or a particular ethnic group can be esteemed for a great skill, but never let them be considered equals in political and cultural rights. And I just think Shakespeare really gets that exactly right in the beginning of this play.
And that's perhaps as well why Othello says, rude I am in speech, as if to say, you know, I'm not going to deign to present myself here as eloquent, even though he is.
He has to almost make himself, he has to pretend he's humble or be humble to make sure that no one, he doesn't get anyone's bad side.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm not a courtier, I'm a soldier, but
I'm just a simple man.
I don't know about simple, but he's saying, I'm not a rhetorician.
So I was thinking a lot when I was reading, Tim, about Muhammad Ali, because he had that sort of, you know, people practically worshipped him in the 60s and 70s as a boxer, right? He was a pretty eloquent guy. But then
And he was not afraid to say it.
Exactly. But then as soon as he... Yeah, I guess that's different. But as soon as he took action in some way outside of the ring, whether it was political or something with the civil rights, or whether someone wanted to do a profile on him as a person, you know, so many people would sort of rejected that, because the only reason he was, you know, worth paying attention to is because he could fight really well, you know. He literally was fighting in battles that in a way that enchanted people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a great comparison.
There's a wonderful essay about this play by G. Wilson Knight, which is called The Othello Music. And he looks at the rare quality of Othello's speech and all these sort of multisyllabic words that he uses. He talks about anthropophagi and worlds made of chrysolite and things like this. And the one thing that Iago says, I think it's in the beginning of Act Two, is that he's going to make it out of tune. I can't remember the quotation exactly, but he says something about messing with the pegs so that the chords don't sound right anymore. And that's one of the tragedies of the play. So then the question, I guess, is at the end, has Othello really lost his music? Because one of the most beautiful speeches of the play is that one by Othello at the end, where he says, it is the cause. And that's pretty musical.
What's the name of the essay again, Sarah Jane?
It's called The Othello Music by G. Wilson Knight.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a...
Hey, you guys, I feel like we have hardly mentioned a certain character, Iago. I wonder terrified?
Terrified of Iago?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you probably should be, right?
When I was rereading this, he is absolutely... Let me back up. Sarah Jane, we did, the last play that we did was Macbeth. And
yes, you know, I listened to
we
it.
We see, oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
We see Macbeth become, you know, he becomes sort of demonic. For me, Macbeth is like an adolescent in evil compared to Iago. Iago is so terrifyingly, brilliantly demonic that he's yeah. hard to explain.
Do you agree with that, Sarah Jane?
Macbeth compared to Iago is an excellent place to start, I think. So yeah, I think that, yeah, obviously at the beginning of Macbeth has the kind of crazy thing about Macbeth is he knows that God exists and he knows that God is right, mm-hmm. but he says, right, stars, put out your fires. Don't look at what I'm doing. And I know this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. Whereas I think what you're saying with Iago is that he has no sense of the authority of God at all. That,
yeah.
As he
yeah.
says, the, our wills are gardeners to our desires or something. Let me check
in that. 1:3, you're talking about?
Yeah, that he's yeah. sort of totally without morals. Yeah, our bodies are our gardens, to which our wills are gardeners. Hmm.
He reminds me of... is it? I always confuse. I think it's Edward in Lear. He has a clear agenda. He, like Iago, does not have the power of a king like Macbeth, but he has a very clear intent, and he doesn't. He doesn't wrestle with his conscience, like you were saying, Sarah Jane. He doesn't wrestle with God's authority. If he ever did that, it happened before this play began.
Mm, but we don't see him fall. That's right. He doesn't right. ever. He doesn't have any virtues to begin
right.
with.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, which is part of the reason for me. There's always the possibility. We kept saying, Heidi especially was really good on this, that when, like, is there ever a point in Macbeth that Macbeth could have turned back? You know, he's steeped in blood so far, he says, that he can't turn back. But there's various points in the play that he could have turned back. He's already done wrong. They could turn back.
Yeah, but he says, I might as well not, doesn't he? He says that, you know, going forward is going to be just as hard as going back, so I might as well carry on.
Right.
Yeah.
But with Iago, there's hardly ever, I can't recall a line in the play where he worries that what he's doing is somehow wrong.
Yeah.
The only question for him is a strategic decision. It's a strategic question.
Yeah.
Can I get done what I want to get done and get away with it?
Because I'd say he's entirely negative. Whereas Macbeth has his ambition and can see a trajectory for that, even though it's going to all leap itself and fall on the other and everything is premature. For Iago, he's simply sowing chaos. He does things by means of negation. He's a shadow. He corrupts things. He's like... poisonous acid that bites into bright metal, I think I read one critic said about him. And so he turns beauty into ugliness. But you're right, he doesn't really have any objective beyond that other than to sow discord, disharmony, chaos. So he's really abhorrent in that sense.
I was thinking that one of the big differences between Macbeth and Iago is that Macbeth has some sort of... He's got, you know, he could almost blame his turn on someone else, in a sense. You know, there's Lady Macbeth, there's the three sisters, there's all these different sort of external sources, demonic or otherwise, that are, you know, playing on his will and on his soul and on, you know, offering him temptation and things like that. And that doesn't seem quite as true with Iago. It seems so, on the one hand, just
self-motivated.
Calculated, yeah.
Yeah, calculated and like sort of internal and core to who he is, almost as if it's he is Macbeth and Lady Macbeth wrapped up in one person. The temptation is not external, it's internal. It's, you know, it's driven by his, I mean, maybe it is just ambition, like, you know, the worst version of Macbeth. Which play was written first, by the way? I forget.
This one was.
Okay.
Othello. So, yeah, he's been described by Coleridge as having a motiveless malignancy. It's quite a famous sort of Iago. And it might be interesting now just to spend a few minutes thinking about what are the things that motivate Iago's hatred for Othello. Because he says twice at the end of Act 1, Scene 3, I hate them all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what do you think it is that motivates him, if anything?
I'm going to express a little bit of confusion on this point, because I have heard other commentators say that Iago, not as a criticism, but he lacks motivation. And yet the play, maybe I misunderstood something, opens with Iago expressing frustration that Othello gave the position that he felt was rightfully his to someone else.
And that strikes me as...
Right. Yeah. And that may not be sufficient motive to do what Iago does. Maybe that's the question. But that certainly seems to me like front and center. This is what sets this play off. Iago is he's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Jane, am I missing something about the question about what's motivating him?
No. I think you've defined the kind of nuances of that really well, which is that is that sufficient motivation?
Right.
Because the other thing is that later on we find out about his insecurity, about his own, perhaps his own sexual prowess, that he suspects that the Moor has jumped in his seat with his wife. He also suspects Cassio of that. So there's that motivation as well. But what's really interesting is if we go back to the source that Shakespeare used for this play, which was written by Giraldo Cinzio in 1565, I think, and Shakespeare probably read this in French or Italian or both. Shakespeare creates ambiguity where in the source there was none. So in the source, Iago is described as the most evil person ever, and his motivation is that he is completely in love with Desdemona. Which is it's more believable, isn't it, as a motivation?
It is, yeah.
Although this play does seem to... Go ahead.
I was going to say, it might be a more believable motivation, but that's part of what makes Iago so compellingly evil, is
exactly.
That
yeah,
he's so murky.
Yeah, that's why Shakespeare's such a great dramatist, yeah.
Yeah, he's so murky. He's so, like, you cannot look inside him and say, well, there it is. That's where it went wrong. That's what his, like, overriding kind of, like, master passion is.
Yeah, yeah.
See what the way he acts, and it's terrifying because he is so subtle.
Mm.
He is so clever in getting what he wants.
Yeah.
But and you cannot discern him.
I don't want to overgeneralize here because I don't know loads about classical drama, but I think that's one thing that Shakespeare does in the Renaissance in kind of making it more sophisticated, not like one of the medieval morality plays where you have your stock figures and you know who's right or wrong. That Iago is more human in that sense, in that, you know, the sin in our hearts is a result of the fall, and there isn't really a motive for that. We're just... quite often evil, yeah.
In line 64 of 1.1, Iago says, I am not what I am. And I found that really interesting. And it kind of reminded me of, who is it in Much Ado where Don John says, I am what I am?
or in the Bible.
That's true, yeah.
What Iago's saying here, I always read that as a kind of satanic statement. He's saying, I'm the opposite of God.
Yeah. And on the one hand, it's interesting from a dramatic standpoint, a characterization standpoint, because it does kind of reveal the complicated nature of this character. But then on the other hand, it's such a profound, five words or something. I guess that would be six words. Shakespeare can do so much in six words.
Yeah.
Both in characterization and in revealing the themes of the play, as you say there with the question of, you know, kind of being an anti-God. But then also it reveals, you know, it reveals there is a sort of self-awareness in Iago that he says, you know, I know what my intentions are. You know, I know that I'm on the one hand, I'm not who I'm going to present myself as. And then that reveals to us, the audience, what to look out for. You know?
It does, but it should also make us really wary, because I think one thing Shakespeare does in this play is maybe even subverts the convention of the soliloquy. So I don't think we can always accept that Iago, even when he's only speaking to us, the audience, is telling the truth. I think he lies to us as much as he does to Othello and everybody else.
An early unreliable narrator, eh?
Yeah. That's just a theory. Yeah, I think so.
So you're saying we shouldn't always trust Iago?
No, we shouldn't.
Which, you know, I say that kind of jokingly, but also on the one hand, you know, that's the thing, that's, it's like Shakespeare warning, we should be sitting in our seats yelling at Othello, don't listen to him, don't trust him.
Exactly. It does make it like a pantomime. Yeah.
We have gone close to an hour already. So we should probably start thinking about how we want to wrap up this conversation here. So as we're leading into book three, what do those listeners who are reading along with us.
Act two, David?
What did I say?
Book three.
Yeah.
You might be thinking
I've got the Odyssey, too many things going. Too many. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you for the correction. Yes. As we go into act two, what would you say people should be looking out for, and what do we need to address before we depart for this week? Tim, I'll let you jump on that first. Unless I can
how
first.
No, how Iago is going to do what he's going to do, because we conclude act one with this bond between Othello and Desdemona. Boy, it looks absolutely solid. I mean, maybe from an audience's point of view, like we've mentioned, there are things in Othello's speech that make us think, man, this is a warmongering general who maybe has had very little acquaintance with females. Maybe this might be the first romance in his life. As an audience member, we maybe sense that, but still, ostensibly, the plot of the play is that the bond between Othello and Desdemona is really, really strong. Mm. How is Iago going to undo this?
Mm. Yeah. Can I go answering that as well?
Mm. Yes, please.
I think it's worth recapping quickly the form of the first three scenes. So initially we're given the picture of a Venetian woman who elopes without her father's permission. And in that story, Othello is the villain. And that's kind of the story that Iago sets up at the very beginning. Mm. Then we see a second thread of the story, which is we have this Venetian island, which is under attack from the Turks. And in that story, Othello is the savior. And then they kind of both come together in the court scene in scene three. And so now, where we've got Othello with these kind of two conflicting roles to play, if you like, we're going to move from Venice to Cyprus, which is a completely different country. And it's such an interesting setting to move to. And I don't know if you've read any Northrop Frye, but he often in comedy talks about the shift to the green world, which is the world where kind of anything can happen, where fathers are absent, where usually all these problems happen and then it ends, as you said earlier, with a marriage.
As you like, it's the famous example.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to Cyprus, which is, I think, an interesting, perhaps, symbol of Othello himself. It was hotly contested by the Ottoman Empire and what was known as Christendom. So Venice is fighting for it, for Christendom, and the Ottomans are trying to maintain it as an Islamic island. And You could see it kind of as analogous to Othello himself, who has made this alliance with Desdemona, who is a kind of paragon of Christian virtue. And then you've got Iago working against him, saying, I'm going to kind of make sure that you get unbaptized. Mm. And so I think when we move to Cyprus, it's worth looking at it as a analogous to Othello himself and the battle that's going on, that he himself is a battleground. And then the other question I'd be interested in is the fact that you've got this kind of deferral, perhaps, of the consummation of their marriage, and how that's also frustrated, not just in the realms of love, but also in the realms of war, that we're anticipating this battle, and it doesn't happen.
Hmm. I love the idea of...
Well, that's good.
Othello is the battleground. Even the idea that Cyprus is an island that's kind of, you know, not part of... I mean, I guess technically now we consider it part of what, Asia, but it's not, you know, it's not really part of any of the places that he might theoretically be come from, as we were talking about his background earlier. So it's kind of out there by itself. What is the closest country to Cyprus? Turkey?
Oh gosh, I have to look at the map. It's there, isn't it, in the Mediterranean with all the kind of Greek islands.
Georgia.
This isn't a geography podcast.
Well, I mean, at any moment. You never know what it's going to be, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned that you were, it might have been off the air, but how interested you were in the name. So before we go, could you take us through what you were going to say about that?
Yes, sure. So Othello's name is interesting in that, in the source, again, Cinfio's story about the Moor. The Moor doesn't have a name at all. So Shakespeare gives him a name. And it could be pronounced more like Otello, which suggests that he's kind of an Ottoman. It sounds a bit like Ottoman. Mm. Or the other idea is that it sounds like Thorello, which is a name of a character in Ben Jonson's play, which is Every Man in His Humour, which is a comedy. And Thorello in Every Man in His Humour is a jealous husband. And we know that Shakespeare acted in that play of Ben Jonson's. So it's quite an interesting name. And then the other interesting, like, fun thing about the names of Othello and Desdemona is that Othello's name has hell in it, and Desdemona's name has demon in it. So again, these seeds of doom that Tim was talking about are there.
Mm. Hovering.
Hovering. Malignantly. And Iago is probably from Santiago, who was a saint who was often depicted on a white horse and would basically go around, is often painted as trampling on the morals, if you like, in sort of imagery of crusades and things. So you can see him as the enemy of Othello from the beginning, even from the names.
And then the saint thing comes into the line of Iago saying, I am not what I am, too.
Yeah.
It brings to mind all these questions of identity and who is actually what they claim to be. I mean, even Desdemona, and Othello, is their story early on? We could ask ourselves if we haven't read it before. Is their story actually true? Are they telling the truth, or did they say what was expedient?
Mm. And the other thing about Othello is, of all of Shakespeare's martial heroes, like if you compare him to Mark Antony or Coriolanus, he does the least fighting. We hear all about what he's done.
Interesting.
And I totally get why Iago is really fed up with all of Othello's boasting. Says, you know, he's always going on. He's horribly stuffed with epithets of war. And he is. And we never actually see him in action. We only hear the things that he's done.
Even Hamlet gets a sword fight.
Right. Yeah. And he wins.
Hey, Tim, final thoughts?
No final thoughts.
Sarah Jane, anything else?
Oh, I'm sure there's lots more, but we're probably out of time.
Sarah Jane, you're going to be here for all of Othello, correct?
I hope so, if you'll have me.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
I said she was a fill-in. I was joking. She's not really just filling in for like one episode. Come on.
I assumed. I just didn't want to presume.
It wasn't a backhanded compliment. It was an actual compliment.
I don't. Yeah, I've really, really enjoyed our chat. I can't believe we've been talking for an hour. It's gone very quickly.
That's how these feel. When they go well, it just dips by.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Sarah Jane. Thanks to everyone who has been listening. If you want to join the conversation, as I said, please do join it online. Send your questions in. We'll try to cover them when we can. And of course, at the end, we'll do an episode for each act. And then at the end, we'll do a Q&A episode where we will try to answer your questions and cover anything that we didn't get to during each of the episodes. Next week, as is obvious, we will talk about Act 2, not Book 3 or whatever nonsense I said. I'll be reading that and enjoy that. I did want to ask each of you one question before we go. So Tim, you mentioned the movie. Are there any other ways that either of you would recommend experiencing this play besides just reading it? I know sometimes when people read Shakespeare, you know, just reading it in your head makes it difficult sometimes to get the full experience. So there's reading it out loud, but are there any audiobooks or other versions of this play or maybe performances that are on YouTube or something that either of you have encountered that that have helped bring this play alive for you?
Ooh, Tim, you go. I'll think about it.
I think for a first time, how do I say this? I think the Lawrence Fishburne as Othello, the version that was made in the 90s, I think it's an excellent, excellent film. It's just, it's a film. It's cut, and the language is cut so much that probably a lot of that we'll talk about on the podcast might be text that doesn't actually make it into the movie. But as a movie, I think it's wonderful. I know on YouTube, there's a free version of a Globe production starring Tim McInerney as Iago, which, okay, just by the way, I was watching it and I thought, who is that Iago? I've seen that Iago before. Who is that actor? And I kind of backtraced him to, he's one of the characters in, I'm sure you guys have seen Blackadder. Did you guys watch Blackadder?
Really?
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
Did you know they're bringing that back?
What's, they are?
Yeah.
That makes me nervous because I don't know how you improve on perfect. I don't know how you improve on perfect, and Blackadder is perfect.
But I guess it was ended, and it was ended, wasn't it? They went over the top, and that was the end. Yeah.
I don't know how they're doing it, but you know, Rowan Atkinson, I guess, is involved in bringing it back.
Okay, so. I'm gonna try to remain hopeful. Anyway, that version in the Globe was hard for me to get into because the placement of the cameras and everything else. Mm. But it's free, and I think it's uncut, so that might also be, especially someone who wants to follow along in the podcast, that might be a good, easy place to start. Otherwise, pay a few bucks for the audiobook and don't buy, what are the free versions that you can get on iTunes?
The LibriVox ones?
Yeah, don't buy a LibriVox or don't download the LibriVox.
So Tim's got strong feelings about LibriVox. We'll cover that.
You gotta have actors. You gotta have actors that know what I'm they're doing. Gotta have actors that know what they're doing.
Sarah Jane, speaking of knowing what they're doing, what about you? Do you have any other resources that you recommend to people? And you have mentioned a couple essays. So if you have any essay or book recommendations that can help people dive into this play a little more deeply, even ones that might help with teaching it, that would be
great. Oh, yeah, sure.
Great as well.
So I'm with Tim. I think looking at the Globe website is a great place to start, because even if you can't see a production, there are usually photographs of productions that you can show your children or your students. The Royal Shakespeare Company is also brilliant. And for teachers in schools, their school can get a subscription to the Royal Shakespeare Company. And then you can watch these excellent films of live productions, which are specially put online for school teachers to use in class. And I use that quite a lot. I think they're really brilliant. I'd also say look at the British Library website. So you won't get performative resources, but it's really interesting to see things like photographs from the time. You can look at the quartos. You can look at all kinds of contemporary documents and things, which just, again, help to bring the text to life. There's the G. Wilson Knight essay that we mentioned. There are also two great lectures online. One is by Marjorie Garber from Harvard University, and the other is by Emma Smith from Oxford University. And they're very easy to access as well.
You know, I went through college as an English major, studied tons of Shakespeare, even studied multiple courses on Shakespeare and film, made a short film of The Winter's Tale, and never knew that I could get a subscription to those performances from the Royal Shakespeare Company. And now I feel gypped, like my professors took a lot of joy away from me.
It's a very new thing, so I don't...
Well, okay. Fair enough. I won't blame them then.
But no. David, maybe we could lead the next episode of this podcast with some background on, you made a film of The Winter's Tale?
Well, not the whole thing, but yeah, I made some Winter's Tale.
But still.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
Sarah Jane, let's probe him on that when next episode.
And get a YouTube link.
Yeah, get the YouTube link, exactly.
That's terrifying. we did part of the, you know how Shakespeare, that's the play that has the one like stage direction. Exit pursued by a bear. Yeah. We did a whole thing where we incorporated the pursuit by bear into it. So that was really fun for a student film. That was challenging. But you know, when you're doing The Winter's Tale, you know, go big or go home, I guess, right?
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, thanks to you both so much. I look forward to our ongoing conversations on this play. It's been a long time since I've read it, so it's been fun, and Thanks for your insights and your time to both of you.
Thank you, David. Nice to meet you, Sarah Jane.
Yes, you too.
For Tim McIntosh and for Sarah Jane Bentley, I'm David Curran. Thanks so much for listening. Happy reading, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.